Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hi, I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer. So I think this is how we imagine our baby thinking, or our babies when they think. We say, who's a good boy? Who's a good boy? And I think that we think that they're thinking, I'm a good boy. I'm a good boy. We must imagine that that's the case. Otherwise, why would we be saying it? Perhaps we just say, look, it's getting the kids smiling. There seems to be affection between us. It probably works. But parenting has gone on forever. And really, thinking about what goes on in those little heads hasn't really changed much except for the last 50 years, when our entire conception of baby thought has undergone a radical transformation. And in the last decade or so, new thoughts about how babies think are being mined every day. A new book written by a psychologist with a background in philosophy, her name is Alison Gopnik, is called The Philosophical Baby: What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life. And I want to welcome Alison Gopnik to WNYC. Hello.
Glad to be here.
Were you a mother before you were a baby researcher?
No, I was actually a baby researcher before I was a mother, although not for very long, because I had my first baby at 23. But I'm also the oldest sister of six siblings, so I had spent some time with babies before.
So you were an amateur researcher, as every parent or older sibling is.
Right.
Yeah. And so do you use you have three boys, right?
Right.
Do you use them as subjects, wittingly or unwittingly?
Well, my boys are completely grown up now. They're 30 and 29 and 21. And when they were little, I don't think I ever used them as subjects, but I certainly watched them carefully. And I think one of the great things about developmental psychology is that it helps you to watch your children and notice all the amazing things that they're doing.
Yeah, whenever you read the texts of the famous psychiatrists who have their own kids, so often it's based on a thought that hit them when they were watching their own children play.
That's right. When my own son was back in the 80s, was about two, one day we had pineapple for dessert, and he was shocked when he actually ate pineapple, and he didn't think it was a suitable thing for dessert at all. And then for weeks afterwards, he would say to me, Mommy, pineapple, it's yummy for you, and it's yucky for me. And that actually started a whole series of studies that we did showing when children start to understand that people could want different things.
Oh, yeah. And when do they learn the Latin phrase for, taste is, what is it? De gustibus, taste is undebatable. And, you know, speaking, this reminded me of something in your book, but that the way you imitated his voice, you write a little bit about the phrase, uh-oh.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting or significant about uh-oh?
Well, it turns out that uh-oh is one of the very first things that young children say, which is sort of surprising. And when you actually look carefully at how they use it, which is what I did when I was in graduate school, it turns out that they're actually using uh-oh to talk about the fact that they're trying to do something, they have a vision of the world, and it's not working out. And that's a very abstract thing for very young babies to be talking about.
Yeah, and I think it goes to the big premise of your book, which is these things that we maybe take as cute baby talk and dismiss as baby talk, or just a baby looking somewhere and then looking somewhere else, things that for years and years we didn't really ponder too much, people are beginning to ponder. And perhaps maybe it's overstating it, but your premise is that babies are not only smarter than we thought they were, they may in some ways be smarter than we are. What do you think of that?
Well, the thought, which I think is backed up by the research, is that babies and young children are really designed for learning. So one of the puzzles about human beings is why we have this long period of childhood at all. Why are we immature for so long and dependent on our parents for so long? And one of the ideas that's come out of both evolution and psychology is that we have that protected period so that we can learn all the things that we need to learn before we actually have to put them into action. And from that perspective, it makes sense that babies and young children would be the best learning machines in the universe. And then when you actually look at what they can do, especially work we've done in the last 10 years, it turns out that they can recognize statistics, they can use probabilistic logic, they can infer causal structure, they can do things that the best machine learning programs and scientists can do.
Obvious question is, how do you know? How do you know they could learn statistics? Maybe it's best to talk about the ping pong ball experiment you set up.
That's right. So this was actually an experiment that my colleague Fei Xu set up. And what she did was show babies a box full of mixed up ping pong balls, 80% of them white and 20% of them red. Then she showed babies an experimenter either taking all white balls out of the box or all red balls out of the box. Now, if you think about it, if you've got a mixed up box, both of those sequences are possible, but it's much more probable statistically that you'll pick out all white balls from an 80% white box than all red balls. And in fact, the babies were very surprised. They looked much longer when they saw the experimenter picking out the red balls from the mostly white box. And that means that they must have been sensitive to this pretty abstract statistical fact about the sample that you can take from a population.
Right. An adult would look at the mostly white box and say, I expect mostly white balls, and the opposite for the red box. And when the adult saw it, he would say, that confirms my statistical projection. We wouldn't think a baby would be able to do it, but that experiment shows they can. But I just want to go back and talk about, you said they looked longer, and in your book, time and time again, there is a fact that babies will look at things that are unexpected, and researchers can really use that to get some insight into babies.
That's right. That's been one of the tools that we've used to understand what's going on in babies' minds. We can do other things, too. We can see what the babies will reach for, or we can see which object they'll pick up. And by looking at what they look at and what they do, we can find out things about what they think, even when they can't talk to us about it yet.
Now, every parent always wonders, what is my baby thinking? And now is the time, if you're a parent, that you could call in, and perhaps Allison Gopnik will be able to tell you. Our number is 212-433-9692. 212-433-WNYC, baby thought and cognition. Now, on the subject of statistics, you say that language and language acquisition has something to do with statistics. And talk about the word pretty. Could you tell us about that experiment a little bit?
Yes, this was an experiment that Jenny Safran at Rochester did, where what she did was have babies hear different patterns of nonsense syllables. And there were different statistical patterns in those nonsense syllables. And then using one of these techniques, now looking at what babies listen to the most, she discovered that babies could pick up those patterns and could use them to figure out what the words were in a long sentence, which is actually a very hard thing to do.
So if you say, you're a pretty baby, you're a pretty baby, they might understand that pretty, that goes together. Maybe that's a word. And if you just trotted out tuba, they wouldn't respond to that as a word. They wouldn't look at, what would they look at more? They'd look at the word, the phrase taba more, because it was weird and unusual.
Weird and unexpected. So the children seem to be picking up, oh, these two syllables go together to make a word.
Pretty. Wow, that's pretty interesting. You also talk about cued learning versus spontaneous recall. As a parent, I gained some insight, and I want to talk about that in a second, that how I read the book, which is like, okay, where are the tips that I can make my kid smarter, or how do I make my kid understand? But talk a little bit about cued learning and spontaneous recall, if you will.
Well, one of the things that we started to learn is why it was that we got things so wrong about babies for so long. And one of the reasons is that with preschoolers, for example, it turns out that preschoolers are very bad at just recalling something spontaneously, just telling you what happened to them in the past. And that's interesting in itself. But if you give them a clue, then it turns out they're very good at remembering what happened in the past. So if you go to a preschooler and you say something like, how does this machine work? You'll get a blank stare or a sort of stream of consciousness poetry. But if you ask, well, did the red block make it go or did the yellow block make it go, give them a choice, then they turn out to be amazingly good at remembering what happened and giving you the right answer.
So, you know, my insight was, okay, so as a parent, this means I should cue them. If it seems to be an uncomprehending conversation between me and my two-year-old, perhaps I should cue him. But I also said to myself, perhaps I shouldn't, you know, lead the horse to water. I should just cue him only so far as he could demonstrate that he's recalling and understanding things that happened.
Well, one of the things that good daycares do, for example, which I think is a sort of intuitive appreciation of this, is they put up a little list of all the things that has happened to the child during the day, and then parents can look at that list. So if you just simply ask a three-year-old, you know, what did you do at school today, they'll say, I played. But if you say, oh, when you went on the sliding board, what happened, then you're more likely to actually get them to tell you what they know.
Yeah, these are good tips for a radio interviewer as well. But I think it seemed to me that there's one experiment you talked about in the book that contrasts with what you just said, which is you talk about this duck toy, and kids looked at it and they weren't clear either. A duck would pop out when you pressed the lever, and it was pretty clear which lever related to the duck popping out. But then in another set of experiments, it wasn't clear which lever caused the duck to pop out. And when it wasn't clear, kids would play with the toy for a lot longer because I guess they wanted to figure it out.
Yes, these are a wonderful, very recent set of experiments by Laura Schultz at MIT, and they show that when children are just playing something that we don't think about very much, what they're really doing is trying to figure out how the world works. I think that's something that intuitively parents and teachers have thought, but now we can actually demonstrate that they're using just everyday play as a way of figuring out the world.
So should we, when we're introducing kids to a new concept, you know, how would you suggest that this affects how we introduce them? Should we just kind of say, look at this clock, or should we say, see this gear, it touches this gear and it causes the hands to move, which is the, I'm sure it depends on the age of the baby, but you know, what's the best strategy for parenting and explaining something new to a baby?
Well, it turns out that babies are very good at figuring out what it is that they want to know. And I think a very good strategy for parents is to follow the baby's lead about, babies and children's lead about what they're interested in, what they're asking questions about, what kinds of explanations they want, what kinds of things they're playing with. Those are all really good indications about, what the baby's learning about the most.
Let's take a call. Jean from Homedale, New Jersey. Hello, Jean.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
One of the things, it's funny because when I talked to my friends and I would sit at their kitchen table and their kids would come home, they would say, how was your day? And they would never get an answer, and I would never get an answer if I asked that question. If I said, what was the funny thing that happened today? And I'm talking about, you know, you ask that to a 3 or a 4-year-old, I would always get a reply. It had to be very succinct. It had to be very, you know, exact, and then you could get a reply.
Funny being the cued response, right, Allison?
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
And what else? Well, thanks for the call, Jean. Any other way to phrase a question that would get a better response than how was school today?
Well, again, I think the idea of saying, you know, what was the funny thing that happened is
a good idea. Yeah. Let's go to Cilcia. Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm
sure.
So glad that you have this guest on. I've been following her book, the publication of it online, and reading reviews, so I'm so excited she's here today. My question is actually, I have an 8-month-old son, and I had a question about babies responding to emotion in adults. Recently, my husband went through a really tough emotional time, and my son was always expressing real excitement when his daddy came home and would, you know, smile and wave his hands around. And then as my husband was going through this really tough time, when he would come home, my son would have that same expression on his face. But then as soon as he saw his dad and realized, you know, dad didn't have that regular jovial expression, it's almost as if my son would kind of shut down a little bit and turn his attention someplace else. I was wondering if Allison can kind of respond to that and how early babies start to have those types of responses to a people.
Yeah, that is a good question. How early?
Well, one of the things that we've discovered is literally from the time they're born, babies are sensitive to facial expressions. And by the time they're just a few months old, they already seem to be reading something about the emotions, the insides of what people are feeling from the facial expressions that they have and the tone of voice they use. And by the time they're 18 months old, they're actually both empathic and altruistic. So they'll go and try and help someone who looks like they're unhappy. And even a baby as young as 8 months old, like your son, is very sensitive to other people's faces.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I told my husband that I thought I was noticing this in our son, and I kept telling him, I know you're having a hard time, but I think you should try to come in the house smiling anyway, even if you have to fake it. Is that an appropriate thing to tell my husband?
Well, I think babies need to learn about all the range of emotions that the people around them are feeling. So for babies to see that people are sometimes sad or distracted, that's not necessarily a bad thing. That is something that's true about people.
In other words, maybe it is true that the husband is making the baby upset, but the baby needs to learn upset.
And as long as the baby is being loved and taken care of, which it's quite clear that this baby isn't.
Oh, yes, he's very, very happy. Very loved and very spoiled.
Learning the whole range of ways that people feel, I think, is something that's actually part of what babies are designed to do.
Thanks, Cilcia. Thanks for the call. And what about, now you say empathy and altruism. Both those words are hotly debated. You know, philosophers, of which you have training in, will say, is there even any such thing as altruism? What's the evidence that they could be altruistic, and how young can they be?
Well, there's a wonderful new study that shows that 14-month-olds, if they see a person, in fact, just a stranger, drop a pen and strain to try and reach the pen across the room, and the stranger can't reach it, but the baby can, the babies will actually climb over a bunch of cushions and crawl across the room, even babies who aren't walking yet, to get the pen to give it back to the stranger. So the babies, even these very young babies, already seem to think that they should help another person to get the goals, accomplish their goals, and get the things that they want.
Right. Now, the thought that I have, I think about my two sons, 2-year-old and an 8-month-old, and we were always heard, you know, the older child might be resentful. Totally not the case. He seems to love his younger brother. He seems to always say hi, and when he's crying, want to give him a pacifier. And so it's tempting to say, oh, he really cares about him. And then one day I said to my wife, you know, I think he's probably doing that to please us and to get parental affection. And then we had a deeper conversation about, but in a way, maybe that's what empathy and altruism is. You know, you do it because you remember childhood consciously or subconsciously. You know that good things accrued to you when you were nice to other people.
That turns out not to be true.
Okay.
So it turns out that, rather surprisingly, even very young children are being genuinely empathetic and altruistic independently of whether they're getting approval. One of the great studies about this with 2- and 3-year-olds showed that if you ask 2- and 3-year-olds, for instance, suppose mom and dad and everyone in the daycare said it was okay to hit other children, would it be okay then? And even 3-year-olds said, no, it didn't matter. Even if mom and dad and the teachers and everyone else said it was okay, it still wouldn't be okay. Now, they said if mom and dad said that you could throw your clothes on the floor, then it would be okay to throw your clothes on the floor. But even these very young children already seem to have the idea that hurting someone or causing harm to someone was just intrinsically not okay.
Right. So in one case, there's a victim. In one case, there isn't. And when there's a victim, they don't want to cause victimization.
Right.
Yeah.
So it seems as if our moral sense is very rooted in this very, very basic empathy we have, this very basic sharing of emotion that we have with other people, literally from very, very early on.
We love when children acquire words, except sometimes. Karen from Clinton Hill, hello.
Hi there.
Go right ahead, Karen.
My daughter is 16 months old, and she doesn't have a whole lot of words. She has uh-oh, and she has ball and cat. And mama and dada. And just recently she acquired, rather unfortunately, something very similar to oh shoot, the slightly more expletive version. And so I'm wondering, you know, my husband and I don't curse a whole lot around the house, but we do express that. We do use that phrase quite a bit. And she's picked it up, and our friends think it's hilarious. And we think it's pretty funny, too, frankly. But and so I'm curious, you know, what do you recommend to discourage that? We've tried a few different things that don't seem to have any impact whatsoever. It's absolutely her favorite word. She greets us in the morning from her crib with that phrase. And, you know, we try not to laugh. And I'm also curious why some kids whose parents probably curse around the same amount we do, pretty benignly, do and don't pick up those phrases.
Well, one of the interesting things is that when you think about that it's a word that's telling about children about a particular thing, that things are going wrong. And children seem to be just searching for words to express certain kinds of concepts, the concepts that are important to them and that they're figuring out. And the words that you're talking about often also show up very vividly in contexts that are like that when things are going wrong. So for the child who's just looking around for a way to express this set of ideas, that sort of word seems like a very relevant and appropriate one.
Yeah, so it's a, I think I'm using the catch-22 phrase right. The parents that perhaps casually use profanity, maybe the child won't acquire the profanity, but when the parents act like it's a big deal, then the kid gloms onto it immediately.
Well, I don't think it's that so much. It's just sort of the luck of the draw. If the baby is out right. there looking for a word to express this, and this just happens to be the vivid word that they hear at that particular time, then the babies aren't just passively soaking up language. They're actively trying to use language to sort the world out. So even just one expression can be the one that they happen to choose. And you can be pretty confident that it'll fade away, and I don't think anyone has to worry about it very much.
Should we worry should we not try to drum words out of kids? Does that set a bad precedent?
I think that's just going to be counterproductive. The kids are very good at picking up the kinds of things that the people around them are saying, and if they don't hear that very much, I think it'll just fade away with time.
Allison Gopnik, professor of psychology at the University of California at Berkeley, author of The Scientist in the Crib, and the new book is The Philosophical Baby. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And coming up, what cars from the 80s would you spare from the junkyard? What clunkers are you happiest to see demolished? Our number is 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or leave a comment on the web page, WNYC.org, and click The Brian Lehrer Show.